Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, December 31st, 2003. Today's session is entitled Restoring Peace, Part 3 in the Peace is the Way Retreat, led by Tim Hansen, session number HAT-2003-03. Let's listen in.
I think that each of you have probably gotten the materials that I've set out, but if anybody asks you about what this stuff is, what have you guys been talking about? I just left those handouts out on the countertop just outside the door here, so feel free to direct people that way. Wanted to point out a couple of other resources if in the next few days you have some downtime and want to check out more videos or something like that. I've got two videos, and you can use the TV and VCR in Creekside, right next door here, to watch things if you want. This video is called Hollow Water, and it's about the Hollow Water Reservation in Canada and how the use of circles have been used to deal with issues of multi-generational ancestral relationships and with alcoholism in their community, and it's a pretty amazing video with footage of people actually doing the circle and some interviews, and so it's available. It's through a Canadian film company, but it's entitled Hollow Water, and I'll just leave that set out for anyone that might want to check that out. The other one, a couple of people have made reference to this. I'm glad that I have a copy of it. Entitled Long Night's Journey in Today, it's South Africa's Search for Truth and Reconciliation. It's a video about the Truth and Reconciliation committees that were set up in South Africa to deal with all of the atrocities that happened there. And there's a short study guide that even goes with it if you want. But this is quite an incredible video as well, with some pretty amazing footage. So I'll just leave these out for folks. I know tomorrow was kind of an unstructured day and there's not a whole lot going on. There'll be a discussion of the vow of nonviolence at 11 and some other things happening, but you know, for the most part it's a pretty flexible day, so you might want to check out one of those two things. Another resource that's available is entitled Justice or Just Desserts, and it's put out by the Presbyterian Criminal Justice Resource Center, and it's actually an adult study guide, like a Bible study guide that you might do with a group or at your church, that explores the issues of justice and restorative justice, and it's got some pretty good stuff in there. Gene Greenwood, who's from Minnesota, on the cover writes, "Restorative justice moves to the heart of religious experience. One could speak of the responsibility of the faith community, and one can speak of the opportunity. Engagement in restorative justice allows people of faith to move from preaching reconciliation to participating. Restorative justice is a gift to the people of faith. It transforms us as it invites others to experience the gift of restoration." That's a neat guy as well that I'll leave set up. What I wanted to spend some time with this morning is to think about and talk about some spots in our life, in our world, where we might be able to look with fresh eyes, look through a restorative response to a conflict that's happening, and kind of explore together some different ways that we might move through a conflict situation. But before I get to that, I want to cover a few things that I didn't get to yesterday through our time, and that is to talk a little bit about some of the different ways that restorative justice is played out, some restorative practices. Last night we talked about it and had a little bit of an experience with talking circles or peacemaking circles, and highlighted how that practice really is a gift from American Indians here on the North American continent. So peacemaking circles are used in a whole variety of different ways, as I mentioned yesterday. Another practice that's widely used is a practice called conferencing. And it goes by a variety of different names, just like circles do. You've got sort of the basic circle, and then all these other words that sometimes get attached to it. And the same is true for conferencing. So you sometimes hear victim offender conferencing, you sometimes hear community conferencing, sometimes you hear restorative conferencing. But the basic core of conferencing is a gift and originates back to the indigenous peoples of New Zealand, the Moriori people. And it was through their initiative that the concept and the practice of conferencing has sort of spread across the world in just a little over two decades, actually. It was in the early 80s when the Moriori people came to the government, the officials in New Zealand, and said, "We will not allow you to do what you're doing to our people any longer. You're decimating our sense of culture, our sense of purpose, our sense of people." The process of colonization that happened here in the United States is similar to what happened in New Zealand. The same sort of thing. The indigenous people were pushed onto reservations, were forced to lose their language and to lose their culture, to lose their spirituality. And small pockets of people survived, and now there's sort of a resurgence and a regeneration of their culture and their ideas and their thoughts and their beliefs. And then a willingness for them to share that with others, which is pretty amazing. The most familiar term is family group conferencing. And when I first learned about family group conferencing, it threw me off a little bit, because I was doing conferencing in situations with a victim and an offender and their families, but or sometimes there wasn't any family there. And so I said, why are we calling this family group conferencing? It was sort of a confusion for me. Until I met a man from New Zealand, a Maori man, and he explained to me that the Western idea of family being sort of this biological connection to one another is different from the Maori understanding of family. To Maori, everyone is family. It's really the concept of human family. And he talks of when two Maori people meet, before they get into who they are, and before they get into what they do and all that other stuff, there's this dialogue, this exchange to try to figure out what the family connection might be. And so there's this, well, where do you come from? I come from, oh, well, do you know so-and-so? No. And they kind of make these connections until finally they have a common person that they both know, perhaps related to, perhaps not related to. And then he says, it's like, oh, great, now we're here. Now we can talk. But until then, it would be inappropriate to engage in any sort of business or anything else. He also talked about how important it is to have family with you at important junctures in your life. This man had been the director of a branch of their Ministry of Justice in New Zealand, and he talked about when he went for this important interview to be able to get this position, he had told some of his family members, and the word spread very quickly, and the elders came to him and said, "You cannot go to that interview alone. You know, we must be with you." So he had to call the Office of Justice and explain, when I come for my final interview, some people are going to come with me. And he talked of the amazement when 35 people walked into the room and then had to explain, you know, this is an important thing for me and for my family, for my community. And so we all have to be present for this. And wow. So it's, you know, it's a really, I think, an incredible and empowering sort of concept that recognizes the connection that we have with one another. So in the early 80s, when the Maori people really began to stand up and say, we can't let this go on any longer. You're taking all of our children away. You're incarcerating all of our people. The majority of people in the prison system in New Zealand were indigenous, were Maori people. Much like I talked about the circle process in Canada, it's that same sort of thing. And in the 80s, in the early 80s, when they formed a council and did this big report and brought it to the government, it was also at a time when they were going, what we're doing is not working. You know, it's obviously not making any sense the way we're doing it. So there was a there was a moment of opportunity where some ideas merged at the right moment that affected an incredible system change in that country. And I look at and think about New Zealand, and it gives me incredible hope for what might happen here in the United States and in other places when we begin to learn about restorative justice and embrace the principles and practices. So the Maori people basically said to the justice system in New Zealand that the way you're doing things is barbaric. You call us the uncivilized, you know, wild natives. But the way you will bring a person who has been harmed and a person who has done the harm into a courtroom and force them to stand there by themselves and talk about these incredibly intense moments in their life, these experiences, and not have their family there with them is beyond our realm of civilization. Like, how could you ever do that to people? And they said, when conflict happens, our traditional way of dealing with things is that families come together, that everyone who is affected by the situation will come together and will explore together what happened, what was the harm, and to make sure that everybody understands the full implications of the incident, of what happened. And then we move into work talking about what needs to happen to make things right. What can we do to resolve this? Everybody's voice is heard. We all make this decision together. And then we hold one another to that commitment. So it's not just about the person who was harmed and the person who did the harm. It's about everybody and their commitments and the obligations that everybody has to one another and how they're going to keep that. And so that played out in a number of different ways. In the health and human services realm, in regards to child protective services, they said that when there's a reported case of neglect or abuse.
This is still in New Zealand?
Yeah, this is in New Zealand, but it's also what's happening here in the United States and in other places. That rather than a social worker or a professional from the outside coming in and taking the child away, and then deciding what either the family needs to do to get the child back or placing that child in foster care and potentially to be adopted out, the Maori people said, no, we need to have a family group decision-making process. And that's sort of the term in health and human services that it goes under family group decision-making, FGDM. And it's a process where a facilitator will come in to a family when there's been a case reported of neglect or abuse. And maybe the child's been taken out temporarily. But the process is that this facilitator will help the family to gather and that the family will come up with the plan of what needs to happen in order for this kid to be able to safely return home. And in the United States, where this is being played out, in Minnesota, 28 counties are currently experimenting with the concept of family decision making. And so a social worker will go in and realize that their role is to try to support this family, to look at their strength and to come together and try to figure out what they need to do. Because they, for the most part, that immediate family will have the best sense of what's going wrong. And they will also have the best sense in regards to what are the strengths, what are the positive aspects of the family that can be built upon. In the purest family group decision-making model, a number of professionals might attend this meeting and basically lay out a buffet of services. You know, our agency offers chemical dependency, anger management, and parenting. While our service, you know, we offer money management and housing assistance and blah, 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 blah. And so they sort of lay out this buffet of services. And they also, the social services lay out what the bottom line is. The bottom line is that that your child needs to be cared for, it needs to be safe in the home, and if there is obvious chemical dependency issues, they may say, and another bottom line is somebody needs to get treatment. You know, mom needs to deal with her drug addiction in some sort of way. So they lay out these bottom lines for the family and say you need to reach some sort of plan that's going to address these bottom lines. And then they leave. They literally get up and leave the room, and they leave the family alone. They call it family alone time for the family to develop their plan. Now, it may mean that they fly in Aunt Sue Susie from California, and they may fly in Grandma from Florida. I mean, they literally, the social service of the family group decision making will provide the resources to fly family members in, because this is a one-time meeting. This is a one-time shot. You all are going to need to figure out what you're going to do. Otherwise, it goes back to the formal system, and kid's going to go into placement. You've got 6 months to try to get stuff together, that sort of thing. So they do this family alone time, and it could be anywhere from a half an hour to 6 hours, whatever amount of time the family needs. So it's quite a challenge to the system, to the Children's Justice, to the Health and Human Services system, because it means the workers, the child protection workers, social workers, have to be flexible. They may have to bring a laptop and do work outside the room or whatever, but the idea is that the family's taking care of their stuff. And the idea is that the family knows the best, the family has the answers, and we can provide support to that family in some sort of way. So at some point, a member of the family will come out and say, we've got our plan. And so the social worker, whoever, will come back in, listen to the family plan. They may help tweak it, you know, saying, well, okay, but basically the family would say, we would like to access chemical dependency. And, you know, I know I need to go at least once a week, and, you know, what do you have specifics? And all that's kind of tied up. And then they take that final family plan and present it to the court system or to the Children's Justice or Health and Human Services. And almost 100% of the time, the judge will accept it and say, okay, let's go with it. And if it fails, there's usually a plan B or a plan C, different options in there. But the ultimate fallback would be the formal system as it's set up now. So it's kind of seen as a diversion or as an alternative, but the formal system as it's laid out now is kind of a fallback at all points. And so that's happening all across the United States. It's happening in a number of different countries. I just had a delegate of people from Japan that came to Minnesota to learn about family group decision making, as well as about circles and other concepts that they want to try to bring back and deal with some of the things that are unraveling in Japan. So that's in the health and human services sort of realm. And then it sort of spilled over to the criminal justice realm as well, mostly in the juvenile arena. So if there was a juvenile who harmed somebody, the judge or probation officer or police officers, whoever, would help to arrange a conference where they would bring the family members of the person who did the harm and the person who was harmed. They come together, facilitators there with them the entire time, and facilitates this process of communication between the two parties. That's typically done by doing a pre-meeting with the person who was harmed and their support people, and with the person who did the harm and their support person, and to prepare both of the parties to come together. Then the conference itself might last anywhere from 45 minutes to 2 hours. If it was a larger gathering, it might be even longer than that. The basic flow of the process is sort of a reminder of the guidelines for our time together. We're going to be respectful. Our use of language will be respectful. Our ultimate is not to cause any further harm, to do no harm in the midst of this process. And it begins then by usually the person who's done the harm talking about the incident. You know, so it might be, you know, can you tell us what happened on December 12th? And so the person who was harmed can begin saying, you know, while I was asleep, when I heard this window break, scared the death out, you know, life out of me, blah, blah, blah. And talk about all of the implications in regards to the harm that happened to them. Not just the financial implications, but what it's like for their children to not be able to sleep at night because they're afraid somebody else is going to come and get them. They're afraid the boogeyman, you know, is still living in their closet. And the feeling of violation that somebody went through their drawers, perhaps. And so then they give the person who was harmed, or the person who did the harm, a chance to say, what happened? What were you thinking? What led up to you doing this? Exactly what did you do? Can you give us the details of everything that you did? What did you do afterwards? And what are you thinking now? What are you feeling now about this incident? And then there'll continue to be an exchange if there's any questions in regards to what happened. Most victims, their primary question is why? Why did this happen? why did you pick me? Why did you choose my car? Have you been scoping out my house?
Yeah.
You know, all those sort of why questions. Mm-hmm.
So these are all examples of conferencing, and the first one was family group decision making in human social service areas, chemical dependency, etc.
Yeah.
And I assume that those are facilitated by someone like yourself, a social worker, a case worker, or something. How about these in the legal profession? Are they facilitated by legal people or by law enforcement?
Whole variety. There's a wide range. In some places, police officers will do it. And to me, that's really a great way to do it because it can happen more quickly. It might happen right there on the scene. And the police officer has the option about whether to write a ticket or not. You know, whether to actually file charges. So especially in juvenile cases. So in Woodbury, Minnesota, all of the officers are trained in conferencing, and so they might do a conference situation right there. School safety officers, many of them are trained in this practice, and they might use this right then at the time. Other places, probation and parole officers might be trained to do it. Where I practice it is as a volunteer. In Minnesota, there's hundreds of people that volunteer to do this work for probation and parole or community corrections. So in Dakota County, in their program, there's there's 58 volunteers that take on cases to do conferencing, to determine restitution, determine work service. In their particular system, it's after the charges have been filed and then the judge gives an option for conferencing if the victim wants it to happen. So it's a variety of different people that might be able to do it, but to me, the most impactful is when it's a community member. When I sit down in a conference and say, I'm not getting paid to do this, I'm just a volunteer, I'm volunteering to do this. What? Why would you volunteer to do this? I say, because you're part of my community.
Yeah.
And we're all in this together, and so we need to figure out how to do this in a good way. The doors just start flying open. It disarms people's defensiveness to realize that there are people that are actually willing to come in and spend an evening, you know, to volunteer their time.
It's like you're hitting the note on the pitch pipe and everything goes to that level.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Is it difficult to be sure that the volunteer has the skills?
Oh, the programs are and that's part of my job now through the Department of Corrections, is sort of quality assurance and trainings. And so to be a conference facilitator is a full three-day training.
Wow.
in the curriculum of restorative group conferencing. In health and human services, I'm about to go through that training. It's also a three-day training. And then you're required to kind of do skills-based training every 3 months, so to continue to keep up your skills and learn new things. Yeah. In circles, by the way, that we did last night, the basic circle training is 4 days. And then to become a circle keeper, there isn't necessarily a curriculum set up for circle keeping because it's considered to be kind of a called position. I mean, some people are sort of called to be a circle keeper, and so for some people, it might not necessarily take any training if they have experience in group dynamics, schooling, social work, psychology, all that sort of thing. Where somebody else, even if they've been through all that training and they might do hours of training as a circle keeper, and it's still something that's just not going to connect.
Mm-hmm.
Something that's just not going to work for them necessarily. So it's kind of interesting.
So, like when I go back to Gresham, Troutdale,
mm-hmm.
in the Portland area, how would I go about finding circle training or check in with my county justice department?
Yeah, I would check with the Department of Corrections or Office of Justice or whatever sort of local resource there might be. I would do a search on the internet under restorative justice. Thousands of sites come up. And if you couldn't find anything, you can get a hold of me, and I've got some connections in Florida that keep sort of a national directory of restorative justice programs going on across the country.
Cool.
Yeah. So back to New Zealand and the Maori people and the justice system kind of being a little reluctant at first, but eventually opening up. And actually in 1987, they passed national legislation that said all juvenile cases will be referred through this family group decision-making process. As a result of that, every single one of their juvenile detention centers have been closed down, except for one, and that's for the serious chronic juvenile offenders, cases of murder and very violent offenders. Otherwise, they've emptied out all of their juvenile correctional facilities because they deal with it now at a local level. They've involved the local community. They've re-empowered the elders of the communities to come together. And when they deal with the conflict in this sort of way, it ends. It ends. It doesn't continue. So it's pretty amazing. I don't have the...
Wow, when did they close up?
Well, the legislation passed, I believe it was in 1987. And I mean, I don't know when they all closed. I just know that they're all closed now.
Wow. So this has been going on for at least a little while.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So what I do know is that within the first year of implementing this, there was a 50% reduction in the number of juvenile cases.
Wow.
So that happened pretty quickly, initially. And actually, I mean, in the United States, they say that about 90% of juvenile crime is committed by 7% of the juvenile offenders that have been arrested. So... some of the way that we address juvenile delinquency issues has changed because it's not so much as, oh my God, there's all these kids just going wild. It's more there's kind of a small group of kids that are doing a lot of harm. And so that's where the most intense intervention needs to happen, potentially there. They call it the 7% rule or something like that. So with conferencing, it eventually drifted from New Zealand over to Australia. And it was more in Australia, and they call the Wagga Wagga model, where the conferencing within the justice system kind of became a little more honed down and some more formal structure was put around it. And then from Australia, it came to the United States, and that was in the early 90s. And since then, it has literally spread all across the world. It looks different in different places. In Hawaii, for example, and that's the beautiful thing about restorative justice, is that it's meant to be fluid and flexible and adapt to whatever community it is that's looking at implementing it. So in Hawaii, for instance, the indigenous people of the island looked at these models and said, well, we've got some of our own traditional way of doing things. How can we add this into it? So they sort of added it that way. But again, the overall kind of framing of it is just usually called conferencing. And it's this facilitated way of people coming together. You're probably familiar with victim offender mediation. You know, in the last 30 years, that's become a pretty common, more understood sort of concept. But it was in 1974 up in Canada when a judge that was dealing with a case with two young men who had victimized over 120 people in a small community area. They just went down and broke out car windows and just did a huge amount of vandalism. And the judge began hearing this case and just thought, oh my God, this is gonna take the rest of my life, you know, to run all these victims through and hear all these cases. So he and the two attorneys came up with this idea that, you know, someone needs to go out and just interview all of these victims. And maybe they could get together with these two young men and maybe they can sort of figure out what needs to happen, you know, and not take up so much of the court time. And that kind of gave birth to the concept of victim offender mediation, the concept of mediation, or victim offender reconciliation project, VORP, so sort of some of the earlier models of that. And in 76, that concept then sort of migrated down into the United States and now it's pretty widespread nationwide, the idea of mediation. And that's where someone who's trained as a mediator will bring two people together that have been involved in a conflict. Mediation certainly fits within the realm of restorative justice, but when it moves into crimes of severe violence, there's some discomfort using the term mediation because some people have been harmed who said, I don't have anything to mediate. I'm not going to give. It's already been taken from me. And so we talk about mediated dialogues, victim offender mediated dialogues. I've recently gone through that training, it was pretty intense. But it's a matter of when someone who has been harmed in a crime of severe violence, such as murder, rape, issues of terrorism, for the most part, they just have a bunch of questions that they want to have answered. And so there's preparation work that's done with the survivors, with the victims, and then also with the offender. And that preparation work can take months of making sure that it's going to be a safe encounter, that there isn't going to be any further harm, that the expectations that the two parties have are realistic and we're going to be able to have a good encounter. And then this mediated dialogue happens typically at correctional facilities because the crimes of severe violence, the offenders are incarcerated. And they come together to just sort of explore, you know, what happened and if there are any particular questions. A video that I also have that I'll set out is called Glimmer of Hope, which is the story of Don Struford and his wife Mary and their daughter Karen from Grand Rapids, Minnesota. Their daughter Karen in 97 was kidnapped, raped, and murdered and left out in the woods. And Don and Mary, it was pretty incredible, within 2 years, were very firm that they wanted to meet with the two men that committed this murder. Typically, in crimes of severe violence, it seems after 5 to 7 years, people might be at a spot where they begin to think, maybe I want to meet with this person, maybe I have some questions. Don and Mary moved along pretty quickly in regards to wanting to do that. Don's a psychologist, and I think that's part of what moved him to be at that spot.
So you don't think that it was anything to do with their faith structure?
Absolutely. Absolutely to do with their faith structure as well. But, yeah, I mean, that definitely was part of it. Yeah. And so Don and Mary and their daughter, their younger daughter, also wanted to meet with the one man. And these were two guys from their community. Grand Rapids, Minnesota is a small community. And these guys that did this were from that community. The one guy had just moved in. He wasn't originally from the area. And so the video, Glimmer of Hope, has some footage from that actual mediated dialogue, which is pretty rare because for the most time, those are just, well, you can imagine, they're incredibly private, incredibly intense, and rarely do they want a camera in there videotaping the process. But for Don and Mary and for many survivors, you know, the questions that they have in their mind that's perhaps stumbling blocks on their journey towards a sense of healing or are questions that only one person has the answer to, and that's the person that committed the crime. And so when they asked about what were Karen's last words, did she suffer? Was she alive when you left her in the woods? Did she know you? Did she talk to you? I mean, all these incredibly intense questions that getting the answers to can help regain some source of peace. And for some people, it's important for them to get together with the person who did the harm so that they can offer forgiveness. Which are really intense encounters, because many times the offender's not at the point of being able to accept that sense of forgiveness. Sometimes offenders are asking for that sense of forgiveness and the survivors are not willing or interested in offering that. So it's really kind of tricky and interesting encounters that can happen. But again, I mean, to be a facilitator or a mediator or a keeper when in these processes, when people come together, I mean, you're standing on holy ground. It's just incredible to see the spirit that just swirls in that midst. And sometimes you walk away from it, and it's not even about the dialogue or the words that were exchanged. It was just something about the spirits coming together of those people and somehow connecting. Many times it's recognizing the humanity in one another. And these can even be in lower kind of cases. I did a case where a juvenile did some graffiti on the side of a building, and this man was so angry about it because his buildings had been graffitied over and over and over again. And when I approached him about doing the conferencing, initially he was like, no, I'm glad they got the little shit, and you know, I hope they lock him up. And I had met with this kid, and he's, you know, a 14-year-old kid, and he had done a horrible thing, but he wasn't a horrible person at all. So initially the property owner said, no, have my daughter, you know, see if my daughter wants to do this. And his daughter was, who helped run the business, was open to meeting with this young man and his mother. And then just before we got ready to do the conference, the father decided that he wanted to come in, take a look at this kid, see what was going on. So I met with him real briefly in preparation, and then he came in, and his first words were, well, you don't have any horns. And I don't think you have a tail. I mean, you almost look like a decent kid. You know, and the kid's like, yes, sir. You know, and an incredible encounter, you know, to then watch them try to discuss about what happened, and for the property owner to, you know, express how angry he was because he's trying to make the community better. He says, I buy these old buildings and I fix them up and I put a lot of money into them. And he says, yeah, I'm trying to make money because I want to rent them out. He said, but I'm also just trying to get rid of some of these awful looking structures. And then you come along and do this. And he said, you didn't spray paint the side of my building. You spray painted me, you know. And so this is how it affected me. And the young man was just saying, you know, well, I'm an artist, and I was just looking for a spot to do my artwork. And at first, I thought this kid was totally, I mean, he did this to me in the pre-meeting. I thought, oh, here we go, yeah, the whole art thing. And then the kid whips out notebooks, and he starts showing me his artwork. And then he says, I've got a website. You want to see some of my work on a website?
Oh, wow.
And it was true. And he said, you know, a small piece of paper works when you're an artist that works with a pen or a pencil. But when you're an artist that works with a spray paint can, he said, you got to have a bigger structure. And he had gone to the city and asked them to give him the authority to help set up a legal graffiti wall where people can go and do graffiti work, or artwork. But the city refused. The city said, no, we won't. Minneapolis has one, a legal graffiti wall. But the city refused, told him no. So his two friends were pissed off about that and went to the side of this building and did their thing. Mm-hmm. And so the guy, the owner really connected with that and was like, this kid's serious about that. And his daughter who was there, you know, talked about, she did some shoplifting when she was younger. And so there was some relationship thing that was beginning to happen. And it was pretty intense. The outcome of that was that the community service that the kid was going to, he had to pay $200, which was his portion of the $600 to repaint the wall and everything else. But the other part of the community service piece that came out of it was that they challenged him to come up with a community service project that would give back to the community in some sort of way. The kid said, well, what do you want me to do? And they said, it's not for us to decide. You figure out what is a gift that you have that you can give to the community. Well, it was picture perfect by the end, because what the kid decided to do was to try to get a legal graffiti wall, to try again, because they'd said, well, the city denied you before, and he goes, yeah, and they said, well, why don't you go back and try again, and we'll help you this time.
Wow.
We're a big property owner in this town. Mm-hmm. We'll try to help you this time. So, you know, kind of pretty amazing thing. And he was going to start off by doing a mural in one of the downtown, on the side of one of the downtown buildings. He said, because I want to show them that it's not just junk, you know, that it's real artwork kind of stuff. So, and the kid said, you know, I don't understand, told to the offender, to the victims, because they also wanted him to attend a weekend seminar on integrity, sort of a self-help sort of weekend that they had gone to, but it cost $200. Mm-hmm. And what the victim said is that if you pay us the $200 you owe us for repairing our wall and you get it in by such and such a time, we'll pay for you to go on this weekend thing. Blew the kid's mind. He said, wait. He said, no. I hurt you. And now you're trying to give me something? Why are you doing that? And this guy was great. He said, I'm 95. I'm 94. I'm going to be 95 next year, which means I'm going to retire. And he said, we need some good, strong, healthy, what's that?
95?
I'm sorry, 60. 60, 60, 60, 60. 64, going to be 65. And he said, we need some healthy, strong, intelligent workers. And he said, so call it selfish. He said, but I see something in you. Hmm. And the kid was just sort of like, whoa. Mm-hmm. Anyway, these are encounters that can happen if we're willing to be creative in looking at conflict situations. So those are just, you know, some. There's also a restorative panels or boards where there's a set, maybe a group of four or five people in a community that get together on a weekly basis, and they agree that they're going to hear cases diverted to them from the police department, and that they'll, in a restorative way, work with the person who did the harm to address what needs to happen to make things right. So it might be around livability crimes. In downtown Minneapolis, there's a Central City Neighborhood Partnership, and they have a restorative panel. They worked with the county attorney's office, and the county attorney said, we are completely swamped with cases of public urination. I mean, this is just nuts. The Target Center, big entertainment centers there, you know, the sport events are open, people come walking out, they've been drinking beer, they can't, you know, wait to get home, and so they're just going into the alleys, and cops are writing tickets, and it's not making any sense. It's taking up all the court time, because part of the punishment in that sort of case is to have to come to court, which means you have to take off work and everything else. But, it, you know, it just felt like an endless, be the, an endless stream, is going to say. And so this community group said, okay, we are concerned about this livability issue. We'll handle some of those cases. So if you've been written up for public urination, you appear in front of this panel or this board, and it involves community members, and community members get a chance to say, do you think, you know, you going and peeing in the corner doesn't harm anything? You know, because most of them are like, so what, you know? And they talk about the smell, for one thing. They talk about their fear of letting their children play in the playgrounds because they don't know where someone has, you know, decided to pee or not. And this is really good. They have staff from the Target Center come and say, you know what my job is like when the morning after events I get to come to work and scrub piss off the walls? You know, that's what my life is about. And so they talk about the impact on the community. Most of these people are just blown away. You know, why? No idea it was that big of a thing. And then they come up with a decision in regards to what needs to happen to make things right. And one of the options is actually to work with the janitorial staff for a certain number of hours to go back and help clean up the actual mess that they were responsible for in some sort of way. So that's just one example. Another neighborhood does a panel and board around the solicitation of prostitutes. And so they meet with men who have been charged with soliciting prostitutes to talk about the impact of that activity on their community. Many of the men will say, you know, there's really no victim, there's really no harm, so what? And the panel gets a chance to say, this is how it affects our community. Our streets are dangerous because our kids, you know, might be playing out in the street and you're not paying attention, you know, you're looking for your next pickup. And talk about what the impact is for parents when their kids bring home used condoms and say, mommy, what's this? You know? And so that just that sense of littering on the street. And then they have women who have worked themselves, who have gotten themselves out of the business of prostitution on the panel and say, do you think we engage in prostitution because we like to have sex with numerous men on a given evening? No. This is what our life is about. And talk about how more women prostitute at the end of the month because the money doesn't last, you know, whatever jobs or assistance they might be on, that towards the end of the month is when many women engage in prostitution. They talk about having to try to figure out what to do with their kids, or even sometimes their kids are right there with them, and you know, really talk about the impact. And then they get a chance to ask some questions. You know, our file here says that you're married. Does your wife know about this? Does your family know about this? What's happening in your own personal life that you're making this choice to come to our neighborhood and solicit prostitutes? And so they get a chance to exchange in this dialogue. Now, many of the men initially say, oh, yeah, I'll do that conferencing thing, you know. That would be a lot better than sitting in jail or whatever else. They get in front of this panel, and within moments, like, can we just write a check? Is there, you know, can I just go back to the jail cell for a little bit or something like that? Because it's hard stuff. Again, it's an area that takes courage to own up to your own mistakes and to address your own issues and problems. And so often it involves community service, sometimes at women's shelter. It might involve cleaning up the neighborhood. It might involve counseling, couples counseling. It could be, involve a whole variety of different things. But again, they're looking at a restorative way, and they're trying to create a way that offenders can be actively accountable and therefore move past the guilt and through the shame in a productive way and make positive behavior change. So I just kind of wanted to lay out some of those different practices and kind of how it fits in the scope of restorative justice. Yeah.
Do you think these are examples that strike me as that idea of giving someone your biggest mess and they'll hand it back to you with a big red bow on it. We had someone on our staff that used to do that, give them these messes, and we'd be so delighted. You know, really, they're going to help him make a graffiti wall and give him. I mean, that's. And then the issue becomes when it goes to the next level, where you mentioned the parents who had a daughter raped, kidnapped, and left for dead. And then you get to terrorism, and you get to war, and you get to these situations where the ante is continuing to crescendo. So I'm wondering, one quick example comes to mind of a friend, you may know him, I think, not a friend, an acquaintance, I think his name is Ed Coach. He does a lot with U.S. veterans, and he takes them back to Vietnam. And just a quick story that is along what you're saying is when they went back to the My Lai Memorial, which is a park now, there's all kinds of amazing stories there. But one woman, Vietnamese woman, was there. She's there a lot. And Ed had said to her at one point, is this okay? Because she had lost her entire family and all her children and most of her extended family in My Lai. And Ed said, is this okay for you that we're here? And she said, yes. And he said, what about the fact that I bring back all these American GIs and Vietnam veterans? And she said, it's so important for me. And he said, why? And her answer was classic Buddhist response was that she said, this gives me the opportunity to forgive them and to help them heal, to help them heal. He says he sees it all the time. So my question, I guess, is do you see any of this moving into some of these more, for instance, military realms? Do you see, like, for instance, is there hope that something could happen along this line in Cuba with the prisoners that are in Cuba? Or do you see any possibility or any activity like this in Israel now in those attempts at reconciliation after people have been destroying each other on those levels?
I mean, I think there's always a great and to you can look at and identify the challenges in all those different arenas. But I find hope in the little steps and the little possibilities, and I think that's around dialogue and around engagement of people as much as possible. I find less hope in larger systems, larger military structures, sort of type systems, probably that are so bent on power and violence as the means to get what they want. But I think in situations like with the Palestinian and Israeli people where there is cross dialogue that begins to happen and relationship building, bridge building between one another, where time is spent truly trying to understand the different perspectives of where people are coming from. And the hard work and the courageous work of moving beyond sort of the dues-paying morality or the sense of... I mean, to go to that realm where forgiving doesn't make any sense. You know, like, it doesn't make any sense that I would forgive you, but I'm going to do it. And in that, it's just going to open up a whole sense of power and energy. Where I think... many people, many structures are so bent on sort of this record keeping or the might is right sort of mode that sense of the power of forgiveness or connecting beyond what really makes sense isn't even imaginable for them in some sort of way. I don't...
You know, a place that kind of did work was South Africa.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We had a riot at where I was a campus pastor at Michigan State. And after that, Desmond Tutu's book came out, No Future Without Forgiveness. I don't know if you've seen that book, but I think it's one of the best books maybe I've ever read. And it's all about this. And then we tried to get him to come as our speaker. We held a conference at the one-year anniversary, but he couldn't make it. And his daughter, Naomi Tutu, did come and talked a lot about this stuff. But as I read through that book, and it's about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, it seemed to me that they had reached a place that what made it work, besides it being the right thing to do, was that no one else could win. Neither side could win.
Yeah.
You know, there was no way that the black South African side could just win this by military might. They didn't have the power to do it. And there was no way that the white South African side was going to be able to continue to make this situation work. And so, but into that then came this incredible leadership. And so it was this combination of nothing else could work. But then you had and what kind of terrifies me about our situation is that there's been no acknowledgement that this isn't working. There's
right.
been no acknowledgement that there's weakness in our system, that we're complicit in this. I mean, we train these people that we then go to war. All those kind of, there's none of that. And is it a precursor to coming to a time where this is going to work? It's possible. It is a precursor to us completely falling apart and not being able to recognize anything about this country that I used to recognize in all its imperfections. I think that's a real open question. What it's going to be. But it did happen in South Africa.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, these are real hopeful votes because it has to start on the level that you're talking about before it can move on into a larger, to the national level or to the larger scheme of things.
It was Desmond Tutu that wrote that book, but he said, you know, where did this start? It started in a prison with a guy that for 27 years almost went blind breaking white rocks. You know, which is blind.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the beginning. Mm-hmm. You know, him and others like him doing things like that. But that was the preparation ground for when the time became right. It didn't become right just because Mandela or Tutu said so.
Mm-hmm.
They've been saying this stuff for decades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of a nice segue into kind of our last 15 minutes together and move it into the next session as well. But I think the acknowledgement that change begins to happen in small ways, and I believe it needs to happen within ourselves, first of all, then it needs to happen within our personal relationships, and then in the relationships that we maintain around ourselves. And then I just believe that the gathering of that energy and the rippling effect of that can have more dramatic change overall. And so I wanted us to spend a little bit of time thinking about situations in our own life, potential conflict situations, whether it's a personal relationship conflict, whether it's a workplace conflict, a communal work. A community sort of conflict, or even something larger, or, you know, whatever. Is there a conflict that you're currently engaged in your life, or maybe an unresolved conflict from long ago, that to take a fresh look at that in a restorative way might offer some possibilities in regards to what could be a way to work through that conflict, not to avoid it or ignore it, but to really engage and to learn and to move through it in a positive sort of way, that you might kind of ponder in the next couple of minutes. And I'm hoping maybe we can just break into a couple of twosomes. Yeah.
You know, I'm interested in the personal level too, but a piece of what really interests me since September 11th is the global level.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't mind if, as a group, we spent some time on it. What does it mean? I mean, to build my circle wide enough to include Dick Cheney and Halliburton and the New Society for America.
Mm-hmm.
That's, to me, that's kind of the question that I struggle with now. I mean, I can do the other piece too, but think for a lot of us, that's where life is right now.
Yeah. Yeah. To me, the challenge, you say walk the walk and not just talk the talk sort of type thing, and sometimes it scares me when I see even folks within the restorative justice realm engaged in trying to do this work, but their personal lives are, they don't live it, they don't do it, and so there's conflict all around them, they're disrespectful, and then suddenly they can get into a moment where they can help others to be restorative, which is great, and I think that's possible to do that, but think about the power of the personal change, and some kind of conflict. I mean, I go both ways, and maybe here at Holden, you know, the assumption is that most people are in a pretty good way, and we maintain relationships in healthy and restorative ways, and deal with conflict in positive ways, and then that then gives us the power and the energy to look at a larger sort of global setting, or maybe it's my hesitancy of like, oh, that's so big, you know, but there's still
hope.
Well,
there's often, you know, I hear one or the other, but the melding of those, how do you put those together?
Mm-hmm.
How do you meld that with what we've been talking about for the last 3 years?
Yeah.
A couple days.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to give it to the group so we can do this with you. What would you like to spend the next 15 minutes or so?
We could spend part of the time on each.
I'm sorry, huh?
We could spend part of the time on the global realm and part of the time on the personal.
Well, we have another session there. I assumed we were going to begin to... know your format.
Yeah. the next session was sort of around self-care and more of that internal work, which we could... talk about some personal situations as well in the midst of that, and then kind of doing both, maybe spending this time talking globally. Should we do that? Okay. I'm not even quite sure where to sort of go with that. Lars, thoughts? How might you lead us?
Well, I think despair is a real option in this time.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's not that our country has been perfect in the past, but in fact, it's kind of the history of where we've come from that has led to this. But it seems to now, it's not only a political agenda, it's also a religious agenda. Mm-hmm. And when I went to seminary, pretty much what we decided on, the definition of sin was, or one of them, you know, it was this belief that you could divide the world into camps of good and evil. Mm-hmm. And that if I was just good enough, then the Lord would bless me. I mean, that's everything that Luther fought against. Mm-hmm. And in the traditions, I think that's pretty much there. It's Paul, it's Jesus. And what we hear now, right up front, is that in the name of Jesus, what we have to do, as a faithful person, I have the Lord's command to divide the world into good and evil and get rid of the evil. Mm-hmm. But there is none of this introspection. Mm-hmm. So how do you enter into that? I mean, this past year I thought about Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Mm-hmm. You know, Dietrich Bonhoeffer decided that the most faithful thing he could do was try to annihilate Hitler, right? Mm-hmm. And we hold him up as this person of great Lutheran faith. Mm-hmm. He made that choice. When do you decide it's that kind of a time? I mean, I believe he probably made that choice in the sense of restoration of the world. You know, it kind of goes back to this issue of where does violence fit into restoration. It's like, you know, gosh, the stuff I'm doing, was writing a book last year, it's just trivial. What does any of this matter when this kind of stuff is going on? Mm-hmm. And it's not so much that George Bush got elected or didn't get elected but became president. It's the fact that so much of our nation actually voted for him, and that then when we see the way that he operates, so much of our nation supports us. So I live in a society in which I have lots of networks of people that I feel good to be with, but maybe this is where it gets to the restoration piece. There's a huge section of the society that I have virtually no relationship with. Mm-hmm. In terms of how we make decisions and do things.
Yeah. I know for Kevin and I, during these last couple of years, there were times when we pretty seriously considered moving to Canada.
My daughter is 9. She wants to move to Canada.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. How can we not be a part of supporting this, you know, this madness? And, you know, it's not very restorative to just ignore, you know, not ignore it, but to go away from it in some sort of way. But you're right, when Tim Pawlenty was elected governor in Minnesota, I just kept looking around me, just thinking, no one that I know would be voting this way. But yet, there's this possible majority, or...
none of your people that you choose
right.
to be associated
right.
with.
Right. Well, besides many members of my family.
Yeah, who you don't choose to be associated with.
Need to be.
And I guess that's what's going through my mind right now is... I read the article in Time magazine last winter sometime about Bush's religious and faith convictions.
Yeah.
And the thing that scared me the most about that is this man who publicly is talking about how his faith informs his decisions was basically a men's business group Bible study with no theological leadership in their Bible study work, and that they all came from a similar enough business perspectives, that it became kind of like the reason you need a community to assess call, or is this really the Holy Spirit at work, is kind of the community involvement in the individual's experience. That what scared me is that Bush didn't have good quality control on his faith formation.
And no global perspective.
Okay, well then add to that Mark Hansen in a letter at the beginning of the war in Afghanistan mentioned that he was a part of a group of faith leaders who tried to meet with the administration, and the administration says, well, why should we meet with you? Because we know you don't agree with us. So we're just gonna save ourselves the time and energy of we've got too much important stuff to do.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about we have to choose to interact with these people that we can't stand. If there's any potential of a community impact on how these folks get formed in their decision-making stuff. And that, and whether that just be the Pentecostal preacher down the street, or, which is kind of too easy of a mark, mm-hmm. or those family members that I don't talk religion with because it just becomes crazy-making. Mm-hmm. But is there any other way to really be that part of the quality control of the Holy Spirit at work, which is kind of a weird way to phrase that, but that do I have to get out of my comfort zone of hanging with my Holden buds who, you know, whether we disagree in details, in principle we know we're united,
yeah.
And hang with those folks who don't have a single clue.
Well, I think, you know, like looking back at that last election, I think roughly the numbers are that half or less than half of the potential voting population voted, and that less than half of that voted for the group that's in right now. Mm-hmm. So that's a quarter of the population, of the voting population, less than a quarter of the voting population that put this group in. And so who were the people who aren't voting? The largest part of that group that's not involved are the group that we would think would be comfortable with this discussion that we're having here right now.
Mm-hmm.
So it gets back to despair, is like how immobilizing is despair? And why is that there? Why aren't there more people when Michael Moore and Al Franken, mm-hmm. Molly Ivins, these type of people discuss all these polls on all these questions from this country, that this country is a very liberal country. Most of these polls are in the 60% range towards the liberal side, whether it be pro-choice or whether it be towards same-sex marriage, on and on and on and on and on. But where are we all?
how immobilized are we? You know, maybe despair is our enemy.
Yeah, it is.
Absolutely. I was just going to say, I've heard again and again that of the people who don't vote, you know, the half of the country that doesn't vote, almost all would vote left wing if they voted.
I've heard something like that.
And despair and disenfranchisement are just, you know, the critical issues there.
I think one thing that drives us to despair is to take on too large of a mission, to think that, you know, we have to be a Bonhoeffer. I think we're called to be faithful in the small things, in the small ways. And whether it's, being active and figuring out how to contribute to the Democratic Party and who's our favorite candidate and how we can support in little ways, or whether it's engaging, using the core values, you know, in dialogue with others that perhaps don't, especially those that we have a relationship with that don't agree with us, that we can have a conversation using the core values of the circle that we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's often we feel like we've got to somehow change the world, just, you know, put that on ourselves. And I think, you know, a lot of people at Holden are very idealistic and want to take on too much. We're basically, we are called just to be faithful in the small ways that we can do day by day. And there certainly are people that are called to hire, but most of us are just called to be faithful in the small little things day by day. I think. I mean, that's what keeps me from despair.
Well, along with this, and the piece about the election, okay, so a small number, and we had the other number, but the piece that has been the despairing piece for me is that after 9/11, you have 90% support of these really retributive, go-to-war type things. Mm-hmm. And so the place of fear in this whole thing, and how, I mean, in some ways, how easily we moved to this incredible fear.
Mm-hmm. Well,
because 3,000 people died that day in the World Trade Center, but every single day, 30,000 people died from lack of food and water,
mm-hmm.
children.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that never gets a mention. But when 3,000 people die, and what does it cost to replace that building? Maybe $10 billion? That was what? What was the daily cost in Iraq? Was $1 billion a day? I forget what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing perspective that we're able to go. That piece really worries me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and it's still there.
It's not to disagree with what you're saying at all.
I just don't want it to get us stuck there.
The Seattle Times that came up on the boat Wednesday, I didn't even look at it because I've been down late. So the whole mad cow thing right now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like one identified cow, but pieces of it have ended up.
Yeah.
And nobody's eating beef. And, you know, even my nursing home administrator wants to make sure that her food service director calls Cisco to make sure that we didn't potentially get any of the tainted beef. And it's like hysteria within moments. And the bowling for Columbine, the thing that was, you know, his bottom line in that is this culture's instant access to the fear mechanism.
Yeah.
And Bush definitely capitalized on that, mm-hmm. and that's where his approval ratings came from, because he could appeal to that fear factor thing. And so, you know, I mean, there's a TV show that's called Fear Factor. I mean, we intentionally watch what, you know, and it's like, okay, do we teach deep breathing exercises? Do we, practice yoga for 2 hours every day?
I think it's part of the recipe.
Yeah.
I think that to move out of it ourselves and then to help others. And I think of an exchange that I had, you know, with my older brother right after 9/11, and he was so bent on, you know, we need to kill someone in response to the deaths that we experienced. And one at Bin Laden, you know, his head on a pole, and we were down working on my car together in a garage, and my brother Butch is a pretty big guy and pretty opinionated. And, you know, we got into this exchange and we're all, you know, often at the extremes of ideas. And we started going and I wanted to avoid it at first. And then I was just like, no, I need to enter into this. And we entered into it. There was certainly a point where I literally thought he was going to hit me because he was just, vessels were bursting in his face and he was over me like this as he was going on and on. And he just couldn't accept that I could somehow still be patriotic and not support the war. And, mm-hmm. and the scenarios, what if they came rushing down the driveway right now to kill our children? You know, what would you do? And it's all these scenarios. And he said, you're telling me you'd like want to sit and have a conversation with, Osama bin Laden? And I said, yeah, actually I would. I mean, I really would. You know, before you'd shoot him? I said, no. Not even shooting him. I mean, I would want to know if, in fact, he was involved. You know, and to learn and understand more, and that sort of opened the way. And when we talked a little bit more, and then I also had to be honest with him and let him know that there was a side of me, a piece of me, was incredibly angry, and yeah, you know, could see myself in a violent sort of way. I said, but my faith absolutely will not allow me to pay attention to that or go to that. And so there were, we connected for a moment because I think there was an acknowledgement that he sensed that I wasn't necessarily judging his violent tendencies. So I could acknowledge, yeah, there's a bit of that inside of me as well, but this is why I don't go there and why I can't go there. And we ended up hugging one another by the end of the conversation. I mean, it was pretty much unheard of, you know. But I chose to engage and to stick with him, even when it got even physically scary and the emotions were so high. But I just, we stuck in there, you know, for an hour and a half, and were able to come out of it, you know, with some connection and some mutual understanding. Did it change much of his opinions and thoughts? I don't know, but hopefully gave him some different things to think about.
So this riot that we had at Michigan State, for me,
mm-hmm.
the World Trade Center was kind of a deja vu of this. This was a small microcosm thing, but between 5,000 and 10,000 students rioted after they lost the Final Four basketball game.
Oh.
And then what was amazing was there was fires in the streets. They flipped police cars. People stood on top of the police cars dancing and this kind of stuff. But in the paper, and I was out of town for the weekend with students, we came back, and in the paper were these pictures, and I'm like, wow. And the president of the university said, you know, people who committed this are no longer welcome at the university. You are not welcome here. And the mayor said, once again, the community has to bear the cost of having a university in its midst. It's like, something immediately went off in me. And I spent, really, the next year working on this issue. And we created this conference in which Naomi Tutu came out. It was called No Future Without Forgiveness, after the title of this book. But a couple of things really surprised me. And one was this immediate move by the vast majority of the people in the community towards, I want retribution.
Yeah.
I want them out of here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My good friends, my really good friends that I would go out with, and I'd go out to breakfast and talk about it, and they thought I was nuts.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a sad thing, but between the church members, and there was a large church of which I was a campus pastor of the students, and so 1,000 members, that, you know, most weren't students. Was there any difference between the people in the church and the community? There was no discernible difference.
Mm-hmm.
None. You know, I'm a pastor, I'm still ordained. I think about stewardship and whether it's good stewardship to be in a church. I saw no difference. I preached on it for a year. A couple interesting things that happened out of it. We had the conference, but the two most interesting things that happened, I'll tell you the one. This woman came up to me and said, you know, I really was so mad at you when you were talking about this stuff, she said. But I think because of what you've been talking about, our marriage is going to survive. So that was interesting. And then another woman came up, and she had a second grader, and in the school there was this incredible conflict in the second grade class. She said, you know, because of what we talked about this past year, I know what I need to do in that classroom. So it does bring it back to the local, you know, the individual level.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of pieces in there that when 9-1-1 happened, it was like, oh, here we go again, except on an international level this time. The fear piece. And was there much difference between the church and the community? I didn't see much when I was out. Lots of red, white, and blue all over the churches.
Yeah. But don't you think, Lars, or anybody, that again brings it right back to your personal level? Because
oh, sure.
What are we going to do? I mean, you can read what was John Reed's book on the Bolshevik Revolution? They made the Reds. They made the film out of it. 10 days that shook the world. Mm-hmm. And you look at a revolution. You look at what happens if you do violent action. I mean, you end up with thousands of splinter groups that are all on each other's throats. And revolution is awesomely violent and violent for a long, long time with insurrection and counter-insurrection and back and forth. It's terrible. And it's just as terrible to do nothing. So you can't do that either, because you die either way. You have chaos in yourself, or you have chaos in society. And I'm just thinking that this Dalai Lama thing, these things are taking us all to our edge. We don't know. I mean, we're to the point of going, is it right to do Bonhoeffer now? Or at least to begin thinking seriously like that. We all have potential Bonhoeffers or potential terrorists in us, in ourselves. But we may only listen to that as one voice in ourselves, you know. But the Dalai Lama, or that Buddhist thing of seeing that your enemy may be your very best friend. That's mm-hmm. what he said. Mm-hmm. No one took us as far on our spiritual path as the Red Chinese when they came in and butchered us and had our own children. Mm-hmm. And you have that attitude that maybe what's happening right now, this group right now, may be the perfect thing for our spiritual growth, anyone who wants to take it on this planet. And I suppose for some people, maybe you have to go a path of violence. But I kind of feel not. Mm-hmm. No, but it's definitely
someone
taking,
else is doing it for us.
well, like I say, I don't think, well, yeah.
Chaos.
But I think it gets back to that personal level. What you started to take us to with the exercise a little while ago is, how are we dealing with it just within ourselves and with the person next to us? Because that's what it's going to be.
Yeah.
We're probably not going to lead an equivalent of a Bolshevik revolution or even a Democratic revolution or even a Green Party revolution. We may, but I think the biggest one's going to be how are we going to deal with this ourselves, in ourselves, mm-hmm. so we can get off this planet, this lifetime, without having contributed to something worse. Or to breeding, you know, a crescendo of hatred and violence and revenge and counter-revenge within ourselves. I don't know. I'm with you completely. Despair is right there. It's all around.
Sometimes
it's a cloud.
When I think about Bush and the people he has with him, thinking about Bush, it's like I don't harbor any hatred. And other times I do. but before he was elected, I think it was the third debate I watched, and I sat there, you know, Al Gore is just talking too much nuance. He's talking about all these different, and Bush is just like, it was utter simplicity. It is fundamentalism. Mm-hmm. It is, I have the right idea, and whoever doesn't matter. And when I recognized that, I was like, a lot of things became real clear. Mm. But to have that played out in the world, it's just so scary.
It's
so discouraging to think that we're operating at that level.
Yeah.
But when I recognize that's the philosophical and rooted base out of which he's operating, he's pretty consistent with that. You know, when he talks about conservative compassionism or compassionate conservatism, out of his framework, I mean, I can recognize that there's a piece of him that believes that. And I don't know if that has anything to do with kind of connecting with these wider circles or sort of like, yeah, I don't know. But there's still a piece of me, too, that's just not right there all the time.
Mm-hmm. I just want to say that one thing I'm hearing and learning for myself is that I need to have the courage to speak truth to power, in those small instances, like you're saying to Butch, and Lars, to your congregation, and you know, maybe that's the beginning point.